This is an ABC podcast.
Sharing a Pacific Morning on ABC Radio Australia.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Mornings. This is Richard Hewitt sitting in for Talia Olatia. Coming up, we'll take a look at the thorny question of how to get more women MPs into parliaments around the Pacific. Right now, female MPs in the region are few and far between. In Samoa, for example, they have a female deputy prime minister, but she is one of just three women MPs who won seats at the last election. So what can be done to ensure that more women succeed in the Pacific's political arena? We'll take a look at the efforts they're making in Samoa a little later. But first this morning, we're going to take a look at the issue of travel in the region. It's not always the easiest thing to do, depending on where you live in the Pacific. For more and more people generally, flying is certainly a lot more accessible these days, with the rise of budget airlines and increased competition in the market. But for those people who call Tuvalu home, flying in and out can be really expensive. And so for most travellers, it's not something that can be done with great frequency. So now one, Tuvaluan, Komosik Opi, has started a petition with the aim of putting pressure on Fiji Airways to do something about the situation. They're the one airline servicing flights between Funafuti in Tuvalu and Suva, but at high cost. Komosi joins us on the program now. Very good morning to you. So first of all, tell me a little bit about your experience of flying in and out of Tuvalu. I mean, just how expensive is it?
Hi, Richard. Thank you so much for having me. So for me personally, it's cost nearly $2,000 to get there. That does include flights from New Zealand to Fiji, but the most expensive cost was actually the Suva Funafuti route.
And therefore, in terms of people being able to access this flight, I mean, is it essentially out of the range of most people who live in Tuvalu?
Absolutely. It's at the moment, it's only for the privileged and those who work in the government and get their flights paid for by the government who can fly, actually, even those with medical emergencies, unless they're under the actual government scheme, they will not be able to leave the island on an aeroplane to get a medical attention, now, which is sad.
And, well, not only sad, but potentially dangerous as well. So, I mean, that's a very important factor in this situation. And I guess it's not something that's new that suddenly happened. So, I mean, have people tried to do something about this before? You now have this petition on the go, I think, with 4,000 signatures on it, which would tend to suggest there are a lot of people who've been waiting to have their say, but maybe you've helped them do that.
Yeah, exactly. I think up until now, no civilian has tried to do anything about it. I know our government has worked tirelessly over the years to try and bring a change, but the problem is there is such a monopoly on these flights that our hands are tied when it comes to the government. So I figured if they're not getting anywhere with it, why don't I give it a go? Even when, because we've got some local Fijians who live on the island for work, during the PIF in Tuvalu last year, they pleaded with President Bainimarama to do something to lower the fares, and apparently even he couldn't sway them in any way. So I figured maybe I could have a go and see where that goes.
So tell me, I mean, how have you gone about gathering these petitions? And of the 4,000, are these all from people living in Tuvalu, or are these perhaps Tuvaluans living outside the country who support what you're doing? Where have the names come from?
It's a mixture. So I've gone on change.org. Basically, I did a Googling of what's the best way of getting an online petition done. And so I came across change.org, put in my petition, shared it on my Facebook. We also have a local Tuvaluan, an online Tuvaluan community page called Tuvaluhood, and there's about 4,000 people on there. So I shared it to that, and almost every one of them shared it amongst all their friends. But the surprising factor is that a lot of the people who've signed it are from Fiji and Tonga and Samoa. And what's come out of it is that they also are experiencing the same problems, is that Fiji is also has a monopoly on flights from their destinations to Fiji.
So I guess the question now is, when you decide that you have sufficient signatures and you submit the petition, what sort of impact will it have? Now, I mean, we've been in touch with Fiji Airlines, and one of the things they've told us, for example, airfares to and from Funafuti, they say, are structured to cover the cost of the operation, taking into account the distance and duration of the flight and the relatively low number of available seats to spread the cost about. Now, I suppose from their point of view, I mean, that's some sort of business argument, isn't it? But it doesn't help people who want to get in and out of Tuvalu.
No, and also it's incorrect, because every flight going into Funafuti and out of Funafuti to Fiji is always booked, overbooked actually. Often they have to offload passengers or luggages in order for them to be able to fly. So in terms of it not being booked up, that's actually not true.
So in the end, where there's only one airline operating a particular route, I would suggest it's going to be quite hard to bring about change. But I mean, if you've gone to the top, as you've suggested, or others have gone to the top with the Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama, I mean, maybe that's the way to go, to get political pressure put on.
Yeah, well, that's the thing that would be actually great, if these other surrounding neighbours in the Pacific Island would actually put pressure on Fiji government to do something about it. Because also I've heard from many different sources that Fiji government has actually put a stop to allowing any other airlines to service this route. That's not ethically right.
Are you aware that there would be other airlines prepared to give it a go?
Absolutely, or? Absolutely. There's Air Geribas that flies directly to Tuvalu, and on numerous occasions they have tried to fly out of Fiji, but they have been put a stop to. They're not allowed to fly from Fiji to Tuvalu, and that's been a stop from the actual Fijian government.
I mean, that's interesting, because it would seem to me that there's a relatively small amount of money you would think for any airline to make out of this particular route, but they're feeling very protective about it.
They are very protective about it, because the amount of money they charge per passenger range between 700 to 1300 one way. That's not small money. That's quite a lot of money. And in fact, you can get a family for a similar price from New Zealand to Australia. That's a family. And the distance between New Zealand and Australia is a little bit longer than the distance between Fiji and Tuvalu. Now, there's a lot of things that doesn't add up to this whole thing. And that's what I'm trying to fight for. And don't get me wrong, we're very thankful for the service that Fiji Airlines has provided to our country, and as well as the government. They've done a lot for our country. And without the Fiji Airlines, we wouldn't be able to see our families. But the problem is, that is only available for the privileged. Those average people who live in Tuvalu, the underprivileged, cannot afford to go to Tuvalu or even leave Tuvalu. There's people who live outside of Tuvalu, like Australia and New Zealand, who would love to go back home and visit their families, or even just to take their families back home to see the land before it's overtaken by climate change. They are not able to do that. And that's something that I find disheartening, and it's very sad for my people.
4,000 signatures, I'm told, on your petition so far. I mean, what's your target, and who will get this petition? Obviously Fiji Airways, but I assume others will get it too, won't they?
Yeah, I would love for the Fijian government to be able to get it. At the moment, I want to make as much noise as I can, and your radio station is helping me do that. I figured that if Bainimarama cannot sway them, maybe thousands of signatures might be able to sway them, or even for me to have a meeting with them, or for them to consider some agreement. That's my aim, is for them to really think about the fact that they are actually taking money away from the poor. We are not a rich country. We rely heavily on donations from other countries. Your average Tuvaluan does not work in the government. So they don't have a lot of income. So, yeah, this is not right.
Well, Kamosi, thank you very much indeed for talking to us here on Pacific Mornings. We wish you well with your campaign. It's going to be interesting to see how it turns out. Kamosi Opi there, she's organising that petition, trying to do something about the cost of flying in and out of Tuvalu. It's pretty expensive for the average person. And as Kamosi pointed out, for many people in Tuvalu, really it's out of reach altogether. You're with Pacific Mornings, and we'll be taking a check on the weather forecast for the Pacific region very shortly after this. Pacific Key by Papayani here on Pacific Mornings on ABC Radio Australia. It's Richard Hewitt sitting in for Talia Olatia. Right now we're going to take a look at what the weather has in store for us. Neville Cooper joins us from the Nandraki Weather Centre. Neville, very good morning to you.
Good morning, Richard.
I think it's here in Australia, isn't it, where the worst of the weather is at the moment, with the cyclone battering Lord Howe Island?
Yes, Tropical Cyclone Wessie, which passed west of Vanuatu and close to New Caledonia earlier this week, now passing down the east coast of Australia. But we do have more weather happening in our part of the world as well, and it could be a busy weekend for some parts of the region.
So what are the particular areas that people should be looking out for around the Pacific?
So there's two main concerns, and they're related. One is the formation of a tropical disturbance up near Wallace and Futuna, and between Wallace and Futuna Islands and Rotuma. That disturbance is likely to become a tropical cyclone later in the weekend, or perhaps on Monday, and it will pass down across Samoa, northern Tonga, and then over Niue probably later next week, middle of next week. And that system has the potential to be a severe cyclone, Category 3 or possibly even stronger. So we'll be watching that one very closely. And then related to that, we have a very strong westerly monsoonal wind flow through what we would call the deep tropics, if you like, from the equator down to about 10 south latitude. And that covers Tuvalu, Tokelau, parts of the eastern parts of the Solomons, especially the low-lying atolls in that part of the world, southern Kiribati also. And with that very strong westerly wind flow is some heavy swells. So we're still seeing some damaging swells and coastal flooding about those atoll countries closer to the equator.
And generally speaking, as far as the cyclone season is concerned around the Pacific, we seem to have got away relatively lightly. That's not to belittle those people who have had their problems, and some have had serious problems, but we've had far worse incidents in past years. But of course, the cyclone season seems to be getting longer and longer.
Yes, well, and also I would say that the same the same disruption to the weather that we saw in Australia, where the extreme drought and the bushfires in the first part of the summer being now replaced by heavy rain and flooding over much of the country is associated with a large-scale weather feature, the Indian Ocean Dipole, which weakened suddenly after Christmas. And now we have a very strong Madden-Julian wave. This is a wave that propagates around the equator, circumnavigates the globe about every 30 or 40 days, and that's become extremely strong. And that wave, the Madden-Julian wave, is what initiates tropical cyclones. So we do expect there to be a pickup in cyclone activity around Australia and the Pacific over the next 6 to 8 weeks. And we are still at least a couple of months away from the end of the season. So already we're starting to see signs of another cyclone, or possibly a third in the longer range of the computer model forecast right now. So I think it's going to be a busy end to February right across the Pacific and into northern Australia.
Neville, thanks very much indeed. That's Neville Coop there at the Nandraki Weather Centre with the immediate outlook. And also, I guess, looking further ahead, we may still have some rough weather to contend with in the Pacific over the next couple of months. So 14 minutes to 8 o'clock, Eastern Australian Daylight Saving Time. And we're going to take a look at some of the news stories making headlines around the Pacific right now. And taking a look for us, it's Jordan Fennell.
Morning, Richard. How are you going?
Yeah, good so far.
Yeah, it's good. So starting off, we've got the dreaded rhinoceros beetle in Vanuatu. It has continued to spread, unfortunately. It was found in North Efate back in last July, but now it's been found in the west of Vanuatu. And it's not good news because the dreaded rhinoceros beetle is an invasive species and it's known for destroying coconut plantations in Vanuatu. Last year, there was a state of emergency declared for it, but we haven't heard whether or not there'll be another state of emergency declared this time around.
Now, from that to a Solomon Islands MP facing a bit of a backlash after awarding a scholarship to her husband.
Yes. So local media reports that the MP, Lynell Tanagada, gave away one of six scholarships that are for her constituency to her husband. Lynell Tanagada, back in 2018, was voted in as the first ever female MP for the Western Province there. And Transparency Solomon Islands is calling it corrupt, and they also claim that it seems to be a common practice for parliamentarians there to give away awards to their family members, which they're not happy with because those scholarships come from taxpayer money.
Now, this is a story from outside the region. Paleontologists unearthed new fossils in Venezuela and Colombia, two South American countries, that reveal more about one of the largest turtles to have ever lived. So what more do we know? And I hope you've been practicing your Latin.
Well, so this turtle has been called Stupendimus geographicus, which kind of sounds like a gladiator name to me. And it is gladiator proportions, I would say, because it reaches up to 4 metres in length, apparently. They've discovered a 3-metre long shell from Stupendimus geographicus, and researchers have found that it lived in the wetlands in South America around 7 million years ago. They also believe that the male turtles had horns to fight their rivals.
Sounds pretty grim. By that size, I'm guessing they were good swimmers, so maybe they might dig one up in the Pacific one day.
Exactly. You never know.
Okay, a look at some of the headlines from around the region and from further afield. Jordan, thanks very much indeed. And very shortly here on Pacific Mornings, we'll be taking a look at that thorny question of female representation in Pacific parliaments. Very few female MPs around the region still. We'll take a look at what they're doing in Samoa to try and redress the balance.
Police arresting
What are you waiting for? The Lady Jasanel Band with the Problem Education here on Pacific Mornings on ABC Radio Australia. Richard Hewitt with you, sitting in for Talia Olatia on what is Valentine's Day today. Whether there's a connection or not, I have no idea. A story that's been covered a lot here on this program and on our sister program Pacific Beat as well, the low representation of women in Pacific parliaments. It's a problem, no doubt, that Samoa is trying to tackle now, even though their next general election isn't until next year. The last election in 2011, just 8 of 162 candidates were women and only 3 won a seat in Parliament. So in an effort to encourage more female candidates to put their hands up to run, the latest in a series of women in leadership programs has been launched in Samoa with assistance from the United Nations and the Australian government too. We're joined now by the program manager, Alana Mapu-Talofalava, and welcome to Pacific Mornings.
Talofalava Richard, greetings from Samoa.
Now, the key thing that strikes me about the introduction that I just gave you, this is the latest in a series of women in leadership programs, which tells me two things. That one, perhaps, that the previous programs have not necessarily had the impact that you would like, or alternatively, they've had such an impact that you need to keep the momentum going. I mean, how would you assess progress up to now?
Well, from the previous increasing the political participation of women in Samoa project, 24 candidates. Hello?
Yes, did you carry on?
24 female candidates contested the general elections. However, only 5 made it into parliament. So although there were best practices from that project, we saw the need that there's a need to do more to get more women's representation in parliament in Samoa.
So what do you think are the ingredients that are missing at this stage? Because what's interesting to me is of the 3 women who are currently sitting in the Samoan parliament, one of them, of course, is your deputy prime minister. And she is the daughter of a former prime minister. And her mother, I think, was also in parliament too. She's been there a long time. Is that simply because of those family connections in the tradition that she succeeded where maybe other women have not? Okay, we seem to have lost Alana at that point. Not quite sure why the line dropped out. We'll try and get her back online at the moment and see if we can continue that discussion in just a few moments. So what we can do in the meantime is just play a little bit more music on this Valentine's Day. Will that give you a touch of Savoto?
I'm not the one.
Nongo e Tau Savuto, the artist there, a group from Fiji here on Pacific Mornings. And we have Alana Mapo back on from the Women in Leadership program in Samoa, looking at ways to get more women involved in politics. And Alana, tell me a little bit more about the program and what it is you offer and what women will learn from this program if they're prepared to sign up.
Okay. The training and support program for potential female candidates for 2021 elections in Samoa is a program of the Women in Leadership in Samoa project. The WILS project is a 3.5-year project implemented by the UNDP and UN Women with funding support from the Government of Australia in partnership with the Government of Samoa. This program aims to enhance the capacities of potential female candidates to support candidates for the upcoming general elections next year. The reality is that women face a lot of barriers to get into politics, so the project uses a number of approaches to address those barriers. And one of them is to build the capacities of women who wish to run for leadership positions, but another is to make sure that communities get used to and accept being women in political positions. So this program does both.
So, Alana, can I ask you that the program, I believe, has been running for about 3 years now. There's obviously been a series of these particular programs. Can you give us an idea of people who've gone through the program and subsequently have gone on to get involved in the political circle or indicated that they will come the next election?
Okay, so the program targets potential female candidates for next year's election. So far, we've included in our programs potential female candidates and also some current female parliamentarians who still want to go through the program even though they are parliamentarians at the moment.
And as program manager yourself, I mean, how do you feel that this particular series of workshops, if you like, that you've been offering, I mean, do you feel that they're growing, that they're getting to grips with more and more of the issues that prevent women from being involved in politics? I mean, are you, as program manager, learning yourself?
Yes, definitely. I myself is learning. It's a good thing to also see the engagement of the women that are participating in our programs. This program, for your information, is to prepare candidates well in advance to run, considering the legislative and civic engagement requirements, and also to prepare communities to get used to seeing women in leadership roles. So from the program, we support women in strengthening their pathways through village and district mechanisms, also to encourage women candidates to attend village council meetings and gain the full support of their families, their villages and their districts. Also to support candidates' networks and civic engagement with their election campaigns, supporting existing networks and bodies that support women leadership, complementing their work towards supporting women candidates. In this way, we know that social norms are influenced as communities accept as normal seeing women in leadership roles at all levels.
So picking up that last point, do you get the sense that the tide is changing in Samoa, that it's not going to become easy for women to get involved in politics, but perhaps a little easier?
Yes, it's always been a challenging issue, but with the support that we are giving to the potential women candidates and also the education and awareness programs that we are running targeting the communities, we feel that the tide has changed and will keep on changing from being very negative towards neutral and more positive feedback and attitude.
Alana, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us on Pacific Mornings.
Sharing a Pacific Morning on ABC Radio Australia.
Touch of radio magic. This is Richard Hewitt with you here on Pacific Mornings, sitting in for Talia Olatia. And coming up in this half hour, we'll be talking sport very shortly with Andrew Moore. including the news that the Hong Kong Sevens have been postponed, the Singapore Sevens as well, all because of the coronavirus. The tournament's been put back to October. So what impact will that have on the World Rugby Sevens series and, of course, the Olympic Sevens tournament in Tokyo as well? And in what is Congenital Heart Defect Awareness Week, we hear a very personal story from a grandmother in Fiji, where around 200 babies a year are born with a defect and treatment can be hard to find. Those are the items coming up in this half hour of Pacific Mornings. We'll touch base with Andrew Moore from ABC Grandstand after this.
We never see each other another day. In night time come we are back together again. We never see each other another day. You won't be singing.
Music out of Vanuatu, Stan and the Earth Force with a track called 6925. Not too hard a title to think about, I guess. You're listening to Pacific Mornings here on ABC Radio Australia. It's Richard Hewitt sitting in on this Valentine's Day for Talia Ulatea. Time to talk sport now, and some big news developing overnight, which will be of interest, I'm sure, to plenty of people in the Pacific. And we're joined now by Andrew Moore from ABC Grandstand. Andrew, good morning to you.
Hey, Richard, how are you going?
Yeah, good, thanks. So the decision has been taken by World Rugby to postpone the Hong Kong Sevens and the Singapore Sevens, part of the World Rugby Sevens series. They were scheduled for April. They've been put back to October. This is going to cause a bit of chaos, isn't it, for the Rugby Sevens teams?
Yeah, you'd think so. There's now a fair while between tournaments, having played in Sydney two weekends ago at the new stadium in Western Sydney. Look, I'm not sure that it comes as a total shock. I guess the fact both have been called off is a surprise in the same day. They've obviously decided to err on the side of safety and now there's a long gap for the players from around the world as well. So, you know, the Chinese Formula One Grand Prix has been called off. There's many events have been called off. We've had the Chinese women's national football team here in Australia playing Olympic qualifiers. They played the Australian Matildas last night, in fact, and they got transferred from China to here. And then the Chinese team were placed in quarantine for about 10 days before they were allowed to train and take the field. So this is being affected all around the world, isn't it? Sporting events, probably the least of the concerns, but definitely they're being affected. And now we're seeing it with the sevens.
So I would presume there's going to be coaches in Fiji and Samoa and Australia and New Zealand, a lot of head scratching to do over the next few days, because they will have had a strategy in place for the World Rugby Sevens Series and the Olympics. And now they've got to completely rearrange that.
Yeah, and that's, you know, aside from training schedules and playing games at a lot of times, they travel a lot. So their routine would be based around their travel. I mean, they're going from one country to the other week after week. So they would have that routine down pat. They would have every minute accounted for in the lead up to tournaments. So you're right, the coaches and their staff are going to be coming up with whole new formulas here to ensure that leading into the Tokyo Olympics, first and foremost, that they're not behind schedule, because a long time between games and tournaments, players, you know, they can get sick of training after all that time. I mean, the appeal of playing sevens for a lot of these guys and girls is that they play all the time. It's not just about the training. And now they're going to have a long time between events. So you're right. I think it will play a role. And the smartest teams in terms of their coaching structure and their leadership group within the playing ranks, whether it's the men or women's teams, they're probably going to prosper as this year goes along.
And what is interesting also is that as well as the main event, the Hong Kong Sevens, they also have the tournament which decides which team qualifies for the following year's World Series. And they've invented this new thing now called the Men's World Rugby Sevens Challenger Series. That kicks off in Chile this weekend, and then they'll be around in Uruguay. And then the final round was meant to be in Hong Kong in April, and that will be put back too. So in our case, in the Pacific, Tonga and Papua New Guinea involved. I mean, it's going to cause more chaos for them because they're not used to this. This is a complete new tournament for them.
Yeah, 100%. Mind you, I will say this, Richard, on maybe a little more flippant note. I want to come back in my next lifetime as a Sevens rugby player. The opportunity to see the world is extraordinary. And even you get this Challenger Series, as you say, starting in Chile. What great thing for Tonga and PG, for example, representing the Pacific nations. But for all these teams to get a chance to advance and play more serious games, but they're playing all over the world. But you're right, it's hard to see that tournament going ahead in Hong Kong. Obviously, has been put back, so it remains to be seen what happens there.
Now, let's switch code to rugby league, and in particular, the Rugby League Nines are coming up this weekend here in Australia. And I noticed, for example, that they're getting very excited in Papua New Guinea, because I think they've got half a dozen players involved in various NRL teams in the Nines. I mean, big Pacific influence, of course, as we know, in the NRL, but PNG perhaps beginning to have more of an influence than they've had in the past.
Yeah, and look, their national team, it really, for me, it started for them, not that the interest started here, but at the 2017 World Cup, when the Kumuls had three home games at the National Stadium in Port Moresby, three sellouts, three wins. And we see them out in Australia once a year playing mid-year in the representative round. And we've seen a number of their players represent NRL teams, and that's the case here. Fiji also extremely well represented. In fact, one of the glamour players in the Nines, as he was throughout his NRL season debut last year, Maika Sivo, the winger for the Parramatta Eels. Now, I know he's got some legal strife to deal with, but he's been given permission to play, and it wouldn't surprise me to see him be the leading try scorer in this Nines tournament. As you say, it gets underway tonight. There's 10 games, men's and women's. It starts and finishes tonight with NRLW teams. First up, Warriors and Roosters, and then at the end of the night, Broncos and Dragons. And then the men's games start with the NRL defending champion Sydney Roosters against Penrith Warriors, Knights, Bulldogs, Eels. The Eels seem to be the favourite among all the captains that have been polled. Because of Maika Sivo and Clint Gutherson and Mitch Moses and Blake Ferguson, they've got a really impressive list. There's great prize money here. It's about $800,000 or $900,000 to the winning side. So not too many NRL clubs can afford to treat that lightly. But look, after a long off season, it's going to be great to see them back in action. So that's 10 games tonight, 20 games tomorrow over in Perth from early afternoon to late in the evening, including all the finals, men's and women's. But there should be some really exciting attacking footy to watch, no doubt, over the weekend.
And as far as the 15-a-side game is concerned, we're up to round three in the Super Rugby season, and I think already it's fair to say, possibly with the honourable exception of the Brumbies, but they're yet to play anybody from outside Australia, the Australian teams are struggling again.
They are, big time, and there's a big game tonight along that vein in Melbourne, with the Melbourne Rebels playing the New South Wales Waratahs. Both teams yet to have a win. Both teams have been pretty ordinary. The Waratahs were good in the first half against the defending champion Canterbury Crusaders in the opening round over in Christchurch, but they got hammered by the Auckland Blues last weekend in Newcastle, and the Blues are expected to be touched up by the Canterbury Crusaders tonight at Eden Park over in Auckland. But yeah, important for the Rebels and Waratahs. You'd think going 0-3 would be an horrific start. It is a very young New South Wales team, so there weren't great expectations about them. More expectations probably about the Rebels, and they've been really ordinary to start with, and they're coming off a loss to the Brumbies. As you say, they're the only team that's shown anything, beating Queensland and Melbourne. They're at home again on Saturday night, tomorrow night, against the Otago Highlanders, the Brumbies, so maybe we learn a bit more about their form in that particular game. The other games, as I mentioned, Blues and Crusaders, all New Zealand affair tonight at Eden Park, followed by the Rebels Waratahs. Then tomorrow, the Sunwolves in Tokyo host the Waikato Chiefs, Wellington Hurricanes against the Sharks in Wellington, and then the Brumbies Highlanders in Canberra. And on very early Sunday morning, Lions Stormers, all South African affair in Joburg, and then the Queensland Reds travel to Buenos Aires in Argentina to take on the Jaguars, round three of the Super Rugby. But a lot of, certainly Australian focus will be on that game tonight between the Rebels and the Waratahs, because you can probably dismiss as a playoff contender the loser of that game tonight already.
Now, the Fijiana are in town in Australia. Yes. That's the women's 15-a-side rugby team. They're going to play the Queensland Reds and the New South Wales Waratahs women's teams. I would suggest that's going to be a pretty tough ask for a team that has only played a handful of games.
Yes, and they did well to qualify for next year's World Cup last September. The squad is largely the same, so it's going to be a great experience for Fijiana. So they play on Sunday against Queensland and against the Waratahs 1 week from today. The Waratahs are the defending Super W champions, the national women's competition, and they actually beat Queensland in last year's final. So they're going to be up against two really, really good teams. But again, at this very early stage of their development as a national team, this would be an invaluable experience for them to go on the road to play two proper teams who are going to be looking to claim Fijiana as a scalp, no doubt. But they'll be certainly worth watching over the next week.
And just to mention on the soccer front, OFC Champions League, there are four groups, and two groups kick off this weekend for the new season, one in Papua New Guinea, one in Vanuatu. And I guess the key question that people will be asking is, has the New Zealand dominance of this tournament finally been ended? It was an all-New Caledonian final last time out, so no New Zealand teams in the final at all. I guess that's the key, isn't it, to Pacific soccer moving forward? They've got to break the New Zealand dominance, and the hope is they've finally done it.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, maybe the hint is what started to happen last year. And you've got to think, with the development of the code in the Pacific region, that that may have been a matter of time that they at least catch up. Now, New Zealand, their club teams will see what sort of a state they're in. Obviously, we've got Group A in PNG over the weekend, and Group B in Vanuatu. This Oceania tournament's been going for, I think, close to 20 years now. Four groups of four teams each. Winners and runners-up of each group make it to the quarterfinals of the knockout stage. So sometimes these events can go over a long period of time, and they can be a little difficult to follow. But because they play a round-robin event, then they get into sudden death games and home and away series and all of that sort of thing. But if the New Zealand teams, as they learnt a year ago, if they take, you know, even a minor step backwards, they could be in for a hell of a fright again. Let's hope so.
What do you think of the idea of the A-League here in Australia finding a way to perhaps have a special visa slot for Pacific Island players? It has been mentioned by a number of coaches in the past, not least Ernie Merrick, one of the best-known coaches in the A-League, till he got sacked recently by Newcastle. But it's a suggestion that's come from him and others. Maybe Australian clubs should give some of these Pacific players a go. When you look at what Roy Krishna's done, who's now scoring goals for fun in the Indian League, having done it in the A-League as well.
I love the idea, Richard. It should be something that's embraced. Look, the A-League is really struggling as an entity right now. The crowds aren't great. The TV viewership is horrendously low. And there's a lack of a star quality. So I think bringing in some talented Pacific Island players, like I cover rugby league 4 days a week for 7 months of the year, and it's one of the great joys you see every weekend, is the Pacific Island players not only the skill that they have, but the joy that they bring. It is, I think, unique, and I reckon the A-League could benefit greatly from allowing that. I mean, even the players have got to be up to standard, and tournaments like this OFC Champions League, which begins, as we say, on the weekend, the standout players from that, sure, why not? Get them involved, even if it's and part of the training, even if they don't play a significant factor on the field. Some would, no doubt about that, but it would be invaluable. I think it would help the competition as well, attract more interest, and they desperately need to do it. So I'm 100% in favour of it. Yeah, absolutely.
And perhaps it would be a low-risk strategy, because these players would not be expensive. You might uncover a diamond, and if you don't, you give a young man a great experience to go back home and pass on to his fellow players.
I agree. Plus, you'll open yourself up to a whole new fan base. You know, covering the Pacific Test we got on Rep Weekend here in the Rugby League, for example, and you get Tonga playing Samoa with a full house crowd and an amazing atmosphere. I've gone to New Zealand the last 2 years to call Australia and Tonga, and Tonga beat Australia last October. And the atmosphere, again, it's unique. A-League would be really dumb to not fully investigate this, because you're right, it is low risk, it is high reward. Whether you get too many diamonds out of the rough, I don't know. You'd only need one or two to make that a very successful mission. The experience of even being part of training squads for players who don't take the step up, who might not quite be good enough for that level, I'm sure there are plenty who are, would be great to take back to the Pacific Nations anyway. There is no risk. It should happen. And I think there's a whole fan base that these clubs who currently don't have it are just waiting for the opportunity to get behind these teams who do take the risk if Football Federation Australia approves it.
Maybe one day they'll see the light. Andrew, thanks very much indeed for joining us here on Pacific Mornings. Andrew Moore there from ABC Grandstand, casting his eye over some of the sporting stories of the day. And just a reminder, if you're just joining us, Rugby Sevens fans around the region will need to know that the Hong Kong Sevens and the Singapore Sevens in the World Series, those two tournaments, have been postponed. They were scheduled for April. They'll now be played in October. And frankly, that is going to cause absolute chaos in terms of the strategies for Fiji and Samoa. Fiji, of course, defending the Olympic gold medal in Tokyo, assuming the Olympics go ahead, and Samoa still having hopes of reaching the Olympic tournament as well. No doubt more to be said on those postponements in the days ahead. Now, coming up very shortly, we'll have a very personal story from Fiji in what is Congenital Heart Defect Awareness Week. That's after some more music from Paul Kelly and the Colour Girls.
I was accused of being the
absolute stalwart of the Australian music scene for a long time now. That song from 1986, would you believe? Gee, that is a long time ago. Paul Kelly and the Colour Girls, the track was called The Ballroom. Paul Kelly still going strong. In fact, I think a new album has come out quite recently, or maybe on its way, one or the other. You're with Pacific Mornings here on ABC Radio Australia. Richard Hewitt sitting in for Talia Olatea, who's taking a well-earned day off. She'll be back with you on Monday. Now, today is actually the last day of what has been Congenital Heart Defect Awareness Week, a week during which paediatricians have been urged to educate adolescent and young adult patients, as well as their families, about the unique care considerations for youths living with a defect. Now, here in the Pacific, every year, around 200 babies are born in Fiji alone with a heart defect. But often in Fiji, and indeed across the Pacific in general, there aren't enough medical resources to help many of those children. And for parents and grandparents, just recognising the symptoms of a defect in the first place is not easy. When Maureen Lee noticed that her 8-year-old granddaughter Skylar was weak and low on energy, she had no idea it meant the child had congenital heart disease.
Okay, her name is Skylar Emily Lee. She's 8 years. She'll be 9 in 1st of May. Well, she's active. She's a humble child and also shy in some sort of a way. But apart from that, she's just an active child after the operation that she had. It started as she was growing up. As a child, at about 8 months old, she had tonsillitis. And because of tonsillitis, throughout the years, they had never detected anything wrong until late last year. She was affected with severe tonsillitis, and that we went to the health center, and the health center asked for us to go and get her x-ray and a scan to see if there was anything wrong with her heart. But from the findings, it came out clear and okay. Then they opted for echo. And it's because of the echo that she was told that she had congenital heart disease. Being a grandmother and having to be told that she has congenital heart disease, it was a bit a shock, because at first I did not know what the term meant until I had to go into Uncle Google and find out what was congenital heart disease, and I was referred to Cyprema Foundation that gave me more information about the heart defect. At the time, there was surgeons that was from India that would be coming, and she would have to go through surgery to have that fixed. We sat with the surgeon, and what he did, he showed us everything that was going to happen during the surgery. He was quite specific with everything, and he also mentioned that after the surgery, she was going to be an active child. And because at first, before the surgery, Skylar was also facing, she's been weak at most times. She'd been having bruises. Mentally, we had to think positive about the surgery. Spiritually, that was the first thing that we did. Spiritually, we turned to God in prayer, and we just committed everything into His hands, and also with those surgeons that will be involved in the surgery. Emotionally, we were sad, but at the same time, we were happy because we knew she was in good hands. Okay. At first, she was troubled. She was scared, and she started asking a lot of questions. And once we had informed her with everything that she had to go through, then she was positive. She was strong, and she was willing to go through it. Well, on the day of surgery, she was okay because she was admitted 2 days prior to the operation. Only thing we did, we kept on singing hymns, a cappella hymns, and just trying to console her and comfort her. So on the day of the operation, all she did was she asked me if I could just pray for her and pray for the doctors. That was one of her strengths she felt when she went into surgery. It took about 4 hours, a bit. I was outside of the ICU when I could hear her screaming my name, saying, "Nana, please remove these things from me." Those were the tubes. But I couldn't go in because I had to wait for the doctor's approval for me to go into the ICU. But I could tell that as she was screaming, I knew she was okay. I think it was a scared scream, knowing that she had all these tubes into her body and all. Well, when we got in, she just smiled, and she was asking me if I could remove the tube. And, you know, she wanted to go home, and I said no. But apart from that, she only had the tubes on for a day, 2 days. And the third day, everything was taken out, and I could tell you that she was the first patient that was so active after surgery. We spent about 3 days in ICU, then another week in the emergency children's ward. and then she was out of school for almost 6 weeks. Side note on while she was out of school for almost 8 to 10 weeks, but last year when she had her exam, she topped the class. She had the High Honor Award for attending LDS Primary School, and I was so proud of her. Well, I would encourage all other parents, you know, looking at your child from the outside doesn't mean that, you know, that that child won't be able to have the congenital heart disease. I would encourage them to go and get them checked and have an echo done, because it's only through the echo that you can find that your child has congenital heart disease.
Very personal story of Marilyn Lee. Her daughter, Skylar, diagnosed with congenital heart disease. But so far, so good, it would appear. The young girl is doing well, and we wish her every success in the future. We play that interview to mark Congenital Heart Defect Awareness Week. It's been throughout this week raising awareness about that particular problem. And here in the Pacific, of course, it can be a bigger problem than elsewhere, simply because of the lack of resources in many cases to deal with it. But I guess the more publicity we can give it, then maybe the more resources that will become available. That's just about it from Pacific Mornings for this Friday morning, but not before a bit more music from Fatai.
Good morning, Tupin.
Sticks and stones break my bones, but words sometimes kill you. Wounds so deep, scar 6 feet underneath the surface. Days have passed, call out your name, saying you're not good enough. Oh, feels like you're stuck rewinding tape, scrolling through the memories. Mirror, mirror on the walls, tell me, do you know if I should stay or if I should go? Love you best when you're naked, the flaws and all the skies that make you beautiful. I love you. I love you best when you're honest with yourself. Behind the curtain when no one is looking, it's you, the mirror. You wanna break the mirror, but I'm crying out, love on me. Back and forth inside my head, forever chasing shadows. Comes a time where you will run, but for now be still and know. When it gets dark and it gets cold, come closer to the fire. But when it burns on your skin, healing will transpire. Mirror on the wall, tell me, do you know if I should stay or if I should go? Ooh, I love you best when you're naked, the flowers and all the scars that make you beautiful. I love you best when you're honest with yourself. Behind the curtain when no one is looking, it's you, the mirror. You want to break the mirror, but I'm crying out, love on me. Oh, 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 love on me. Foot down, I know it's hard, but don't run away. Just love on me. I've tried real hard to fix all the mistakes that I made, but soon I realize
It's a live version of the song Naked, recorded by Fatai here on Pacific Mornings on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Hewitt. Just about time to go, but just to pass on some congratulations to Joanna Lester and her team, who produced the film Power Mary about rugby, women's rugby in Papua New Guinea and the establishment of a national rugby league team. It's won the Best Depiction of Inclusive Sport Award at the Sport Australia Media Awards that took place last night. If you haven't seen the film, do catch it if you can. Enjoy the weekend. Talia will be back on Monday morning.